Set your course for the Huff
Takes Podcast.
Welcome back to Hoth Takes. I'm Eric Geller.
And I'm Grace Seegers.
And Haley Birdwilt could not be with us for this episode, so we're going to postpone our discussion of the second half of Obi-Wan Kenobi, which I'm sure our Hoth Takes listeners are dying to hear what we think of those three episodes. We'll come back to that. This time we're going to talk about a subject that is certainly highlighted by the Obi-Wan series, but is much bigger than that. Darth Vader. Why is he so cool? And what pieces of Star Wars storytelling best capture the essence of his character? We've got some thoughts on a wide variety of media, from movies to TV to comics, but we want to dive in with chronologically the first place that we see Darth Vader, which is Revenge of the Sith. Grace, we see in Revenge of the Sith, obviously, the fall of Anakin and the rise of Darth Vader, but one of the things that's really great about how the transition is shown is that it's not the Darth Vader that we're used to in the original trilogy. It's this more raw, emotional Darth Vader. And of course, we only see him in the suit for a few seconds, basically. But he is christened Darth Vader when he still looks like Hayden Christensen. And at that moment, you can see that this is a really unstable person. And that kind of gives us one of the most compelling things about this character, which is that he's not your typical villain. There's a tortured soul in there that we don't see with a lot of stereotypical supervillains.
Yeah, I think when you start talking about Darth Vader, there are obviously so many points from which you could start a discussion. And the obvious point is to talk about when we first see him in A New Hope, when he first shows up in movie theaters near you in 1977, and he's this enigmatic, cool figure with the voice of James Earl Jones. And I think that's a very natural place to start talking about Darth Vader, but a more interesting place is Revenge of the Sith, at least in my opinion, because that's how you begin to see how he will become cool James Earl Jones voice in a suit. He's not there yet. He is decades away from that. And I think that the origin of the character is what makes him so compelling. Because yes, there is something to be said about the mystique of a villain obscured by enigmatic black armor with no past that the viewers know of. But I think a more interesting character is one who is very human. And by nature of the fact that you can see his human body, Darth Vader in Revenge of the Sith, in my opinion, is an extremely human character. That seems kind of obvious to say, but we see, his flaws, his vulnerabilities, how he ends up essentially becoming a monster who is willing to murder children, the most monstrous thing you can do, and yet it's still within this very handsome human visage. And I think that is a really interesting tension that gets obscured once he's in the suit. So I like starting by talking about the sort of human element of Darth Vader. What about you, Eric?
Absolutely. And I am glad that you brought up, the sort of the Order 66 and the attack on the Jedi Temple. And again, if you think about the storytelling power of that scene, we've now been, watching Hayden Christensen's Anakin for basically almost two entire movies at this point. And so, Darth Vader shows up in the beginning of A New Hope, and you can tell that he's the villain right away. And so you're horrified by the sort of, he strangles Captain Antilles, and you sort of understand, okay, this is a bad guy. These are really bad things. But you don't really regret it or mourn it in the way that you do when you see Hayden marching on the Jedi Temple, because that is the culmination of a tragic fall. And here's this person that you've grown to think of as somebody who's on the side of good, who is now doing these very bad things. And as you said, when you can see that it's this particular person that you've been with for multiple movies now, when you can actually see him doing these things, it's jarring in a way that it isn't jarring when you're presented with this suited, helmeted figure who is designed from the get-go to trigger your sort of villain senses. You know, Hayden, you know, as Anakin turned Vader, yes, he's wearing the darker sort of non-traditional Jedi, you know, leather outfit, and he's got that haunted, malevolent expression on his face, but he's still basically the guy that we've been with for two movies. And so the juxtaposition between how he looks and what he's doing really helps emphasize this core attribute of Darth Vader, which is so compelling, which is the fall, not the like, you know, the Force powers and the sort of, as you said, that enigmatic masked personality, but what precedes that, the temptation and the seduction and the fall itself. That is one of the things that separates him from a lot of other villains. And I think it's really powerfully paid off in the march on the temple, because it puts that front and center. You have to confront the fact that this person who was on the good guy side before is on the bad guy side. How did that happen? How could a person possibly justify doing these things? The fact that all these questions are raised, to me, that is one of the most interesting things about Darth Vader.
Yeah, there's a reason why Revenge of the Sith is so good, and it's not because of its super fun, happy light themes. It's because it raises these really thorny issues and makes you uncomfortable. Like, it's uncomfortable and unpleasant to watch the Order 66 scene. And I do think that the fact that Hayden Christensen was and is very attractive actually does play an important role in that, because we have this handsome hero and he is suddenly the bad guy and doing horrific things. And again, I think that it kind of hammers home that external looks are not necessarily the measure of what a person does and is. And when you see Darth Vader in the Vader suit, like, that's a bad guy. He's in this cool all black suit, and that's a bad guy. You see this handsome guy who's been propped up as heroic, and our instinct, just human nature, is not to see him as a bad guy. And so that's kind of what's so fun. Fun being an interesting word choice, I admit. But that's what's so interesting about seeing this transition. And I think another element of that, not just the Order 66 scene, but another key element in Vader's transition to me is his duel with Obi-Wan. 'Cause that, as much as Order 66, I think is important in transforming him fully into Vader. It's not just because he ends up, you know, screaming and writhing in pain with no limbs in lava, like literally transforming him into Darth Vader. It's because this is like that final nail in the coffin of transformation, is him turning against his wife and turning against his brother and his mentor, against everything and everyone that he loves, and really making this full turn into villainy. And I think it's important that when this duel happens between Obi-Wan and Anakin, that it happens while Anakin is human, while he has his blue lightsaber, so that the pain of the moment of the betrayal of having someone you love turn against you, that really is hammered home by him being Anakin.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you say it's hammered home by him being Anakin, because I think there is a natural tendency to create this division in our minds between Anakin and Vader, tied primarily to the suit, right? Because for 30 years almost, Darth Vader was that suit of armor, right? It wasn't just that we never actually saw well, we I guess we saw Sebastian Shaw at the very end of Return of the Jedi, but it wasn't just that the vast majority of the storytelling with Vader and of our thoughts about Vader, you know, I don't think they ever made a Sebastian Shaw action figure, although I could be wrong, but most of the storytelling and the commercialization and the imagination factor of Darth Vader was the suit, right? Revenge of the Sith does something really important, which you just hit on, which is that it actually starts to get us to have to think about Darth Vader as a person, the person inside the suit, because we have to start seeing him as Darth Vader before he gets the suit. So I look at that duel and I know intellectually I'm watching Vader and Obi-Wan, right? At that point, he is Darth Vader. He's been christened. He's fallen. But I still think of it as, and most people still describe it as, Anakin versus Obi-Wan, because we have, even us, you know, young people who didn't grow up with the original trilogy, you know, you see Darth Vader in most cases before you watch the Star Wars movies, and unless you watch them at a very young age, because Darth Vader is an iconic piece of American culture. And so this movie really tries to get you to unlearn that, right? To recognize that actually Darth Vader isn't the armor. He's not the breathing. He's not even, as you said, the red lightsaber. He is the corruption. He is the deal with the devil. He is the moral compromise. And he is the invitation of sin into the body, and that, and allowing that corrupting influence in order to achieve a personal gain. That's Darth Vader. And Revenge of the Sith is the story that where George is basically telling us, hey, this is what I'm going for here. This is who Darth Vader is. It's not the suit, because at this point he is already Darth Vader. And what does that mean for our understanding of who Darth Vader is and what it means to be Darth Vader? And I think that's a really great thing about that last part of the movie, is that he is Vader. He's not Anakin at that point, at least in my view. But we have this instinctive classification in our mind, and a lot of people still refer to him as Anakin in that scene.
I think it reminds me of the Revenge of the Sith novelization, which I am now kicking myself for not having on hand with me during this conversation. But in the novelization, you really get to see Anakin's own complicated feelings towards this Darth Vader persona. And he's sort of able to compartmentalize and be like, Vader is the villain. Vader is the one who's doing all of these bad things. And then by the end of the novel slash movie slash story, Anakin realizes that he is Vader. Vader is Anakin. They are the same. And I think you're right that there is this tendency, particularly in fandom, to divide the two of them. And I mean, it's messy, as life is. There isn't a clear delineation between when the precise moment that he becomes fully Vader is. And, you know, he is Anakin, he is Vader. Both of these things are true. And I think it just really speaks to sort of the complications of life in general, but also that corruption that you were talking about. And once you give into corruption, how giving into it a little bit sooner, it becomes easier and easier. And sooner or later, you have become fully corrupt, which is, all of this is not very eloquent way of saying that I think you are right, that that corruption element is really important to the role of Vader, and that there is something, you know, almost biblical about it, this downfall. It's very Greek tragedy. It's very, you know, mythic, as so much of Star Wars is. And I think that's why this is such an important thing to talk about when we talk about Darth Vader, is because the fall is just as important as everything that comes after.
Yeah, and then of course we see him, I guess the next time that we see him, at least in terms of the stories that we're talking about here, is in Obi-Wan Kenobi, which is 10 years later. They have this encounter on Mapuzo, and another great example, as we said in our episode on the first three episodes of Kenobi, that this is clearly a storyteller in Deborah Chow who gets Darth Vader, who understands Darth Vader. And I also have to give a shout out to Joby Harold, who wrote the scripts for the series. They understand how to portray Darth Vader, what makes him scary, what makes him compelling. I mean, you watch that scene where he is walking through the street looking for Kenobi. And again, like the march on the Jedi Temple and the murder spree inside the Jedi Temple, this is a very dark and very violent scene. You know, just blatant, wanton, you know, murder on the street of Mapuzo. And yet, while it is horrifying, there's also a point to it. It's telling us something about Darth Vader and showing us where he's at in his evolution from, you know, Rise Darth Vader in Revenge of the Sith to Darth Vader showing up on the Tantive IV in A New Hope. He's on a journey here. And one thing that this scene makes clear is he has this single-minded focus on Kenobi, and he's not taking pleasure in killing these civilians, right? I mean, to him, they're just ants to be stepped on. They're not even really in his way as much as they are just a nuisance. And killing them will, he suspects, draw Kenobi out, and so he's more than willing to do that. He's not taking pleasure in it, but neither is he shrinking away from it. It's all just building, you know, pieces of the puzzle that have to be aligned just so that he can accomplish his goal. That, to me, is there's a brilliant narrative quality to that I think some people might miss if you're just focused on how horrific it is. It's actually something really revelatory about where he's at in his journey.
Yeah, I don't want to dwell too much on how we see him in Obi-Wan Kenobi, considering that we have talked about it in our first episode on it. We're going to talk about it more in our next episode on the back half of the series. But what I really want to highlight in talking about Vader that to me is just as interesting as that narrative that you're just talking about, Eric, is his physicality. Because the physicality of Vader is so different from Anakin and from pre-suit Vader. Because this is a guy who walks around and fights and uses the Force like he has had all of his limbs chopped off and is half robot. Because that is the case. He's not jumping around. He's not doing a bunch of little twirls with his lightsaber. He is a hammer. If Anakin was a scalpel, Darth Vader is a hammer. He is just has this total control over what movements he uses. The way I think you put it in our notes, Eric, this economy of movement. No little gesture is wasted. He does not do anything for show I will say that Darth Vader is dramatic and that is an important part of his personality, but he doesn't do anything without a purpose. And we see that in his duel with Reva in the fifth episode, the way that he has a duel with her barely using his own lightsaber.
Yeah.
He's just using the Force, and that control over the Force, that manipulation of it. I think by the time we see him at this point, 10 years later, you know, he's lost a lot of that mobility that he once had, but he has gained a lot of power and a lot of control, because Anakin was this out of control Force. And Vader, now that he's had time to develop, percolate in the dark side, he has, you know, he still has those elements of Anakin, like that single-minded obsessiveness, but he has a lot more control than he had beforehand.
He's marinated in the dark side. He's kind of, it's a nice salty brine at this point.
Yeah, like carnitas.
Now I'm just picturing like a carnitas with like a little like a Vader helmet and like just the breathing sound. That'd be a great somebody make that fan art. The only other thing I'll say is we did talk about this before and we will talk about it again, but it's a very Anakin inflected version of Vader. That is to say, you do still see the obsession with Obi-Wan, the desire for revenge. We talked about it before with, you know, burning Obi-Wan, and we see it again in the second half of the series. But, you know, the fact that Obi-Wan is there alive, he knows that he's still out there and he can go kill him, that is an obsession of his at that point. And he is still very emotional and unbalanced in a way that he isn't in the original trilogy. By that point, things have changed for him, right? He's in a different situation. His relationship to thinking about Obi-Wan is in a very different place. He has different goals. He's, you know, almost moved on in a sense. He's very different in Obi-Wan. He still has that part of Anakin in him. And so I think that's a really important thing for the show to present to us. And I'm glad that we saw that, because at this point, especially when he actually encounters Obi-Wan, it does make sense that he would feel this way.
I also really want to talk about a few years later in the chronological timeline, one of my absolute favorite appearances of Darth Vader. And again, a great example of using Darth Vader just the perfect amount, not too much, but not too little. When he shows up in Star Wars Rebels, I think he shows up maybe at the end of season one, but the part that I really care about is the end of season two, the final two episodes of season two, which have some of the best depictions of Darth Vader, I think, in Star Wars media. And I think there are two parts of why this appearance of Darth Vader is so good. And the first part of that is seeing Darth Vader through Ezra's eyes. And that moment where Vader, being the dramatic diva that he is,
so
freaking extra, standing on top of a TIE fighter, and the TIE raises up, and Darth Vader is standing on top of it with his lightsaber. So unnecessary, but so absolutely terrifying. And so the way that we see Vader through Ezra's eyes as this horrifying mechanical force of nature. And then the second part of this that makes it so good is then seeing the confrontation between Vader and Ahsoka, and Ahsoka knowing that underneath that suit is her former master, someone that she loved, that she still loves, and knowing that she has to fight him and struggling with that. And I think that having those two elements of it, both the kind of traditional Vader of the original trilogy mixed with sort of prequels Anakin Vader melange, I think that makes a really effective appearance. So Eric, just want to get all your thoughts on it.
Well, I think you're right, and the way that those two sides of him are presented in very close proximity in terms of the timing within the episode, it emphasizes that, like, he is this person to most people in the galaxy, but there are a few people who actually know him from sort of the before times, right? There are some people who carry with them a part of him, right? And it's almost like they, you know, they sort of mirror his past in a way. They represent part of that past. They're a part of that past that he has, but they also relate to that piece of him that is still in there and can draw out that piece of him that is still in there. That the confrontation with Ahsoka, it's very short in terms of the amount of screen time there, and he actually does, you know, says very little in the episode. He's silent for most of the time that we actually see him, but it raises several questions that I think really add this new layer to Darth Vader, and particularly back when this episode came out, which was before you know, some of the more recent books that have dealt with him, and obviously before Obi-Wan Kenobi, really an amazing level of depth added to his character at that point with this Rebels episode. I mean, does he care about Ahsoka still? He does say, you know, join me You know, at Palpatine, at the Emperor's side, you know, he would, you know, love to have you on the team, basically. Obviously, she refuses that offer. Is there any hesitation in his face as he realizes that she is not going to join him, much like Luke will eventually refuse that same call? You know, she's going to fight him to the death rather than give in to the dark side the way that he did. She's not going to take the easy way out. You know, how is he feeling when he realizes that he can't sort of bring her with him the way that I think he very clearly also wanted to bring Luke with him? And even, you know, within that final confrontation with Padme, there's a little bit of that of like, don't freak out about like what I've become. Like, just come with me and we will, you know, live the life we always wanted. There's that desperation of like, stop fighting this. Give in the way I gave in and everything will be okay. And he makes that offer to Ahsoka. And of course she rejects it, and you can't really tell exactly how he feels. I mean, what he's thinking, how he's feeling, you know, we still at that point, it's the full Vader mask, and his reaction is very enigmatic. We don't know. And then of course later on when she, you know, cuts into the helmet and you can see part of his face, and that's when she realizes who he is. It almost looks like part of him regrets the way that everything turned out and would make a different choice if he could go back and do it over again. But not, it, you know, that's not the only way that you can read that moment. It is still, as I said, enigmatic, even though you can see his eye. There's hatred in that eye. There's multiple layers. You could say that he is having second thoughts. You can say that he is too far deep into this, and he sort of knows that he's too far into this, and he's just going to go full steam ahead. There's no turning back now. But at the very least, I think we can say that when she shows up and he is reminded of this part of himself that nobody else really is privy to, nobody else who's still alive, that is, it rattles him. And how could it not, right? I mean, if you've spent now, I guess, so this scene takes place 3 years before the Battle of Yavin, so that's like 16 years after Revenge of the Sith at that point. 16 years, a significant portion of this man's life as Darth Vader, and nobody really sees past that. And then to encounter this person who knows a lot more about who you are and who you were, that's going to throw you off even if you're Darth Vader. And I think that that is incredible to think about, that he was probably knocked off balance, because again, take it back to how does he appear to Ezra and to Kanan for that brief moment, right? He is Darth Vader with a capital D and a capital V, and it rhymes with terror. That's a guy you don't want to mess with. But meanwhile, that same guy, he is unbalanced on his own terms. Like he himself is experiencing a little bit of that disorientation. And so the way that all of that is sort of blended together in that scene, I mean, I could talk for hours about that episode, as you can probably tell, but I loved it.
Yeah, I mean, clearly we are both huge fans of Twilight of the Apprentice, as we should be, because it's phenomenal. Something I was thinking about as hearing you talking about this, I think part of what makes Vader so interesting in general as a villain is this dichotomy between the external suit and the enigma and mystery of him, as we've discussed, and the very sort of passionate person underneath all of that. And we get glimpses of it throughout even the old trilogy, or the original trilogy. I think that Darth Vader is, in a sense, motivated by love. It's just a very corrupt, twisted, possessive love, the love of the dark side. And so when he is asking Ahsoka to join him, as when he's asking Luke to join him, and as you said, when he's asking Padme to join him, it's because he wants them by his side. He does love them, but in this very dark funhouse mirror version of love, this love that isn't the love of a Jedi, selfless love, but something that is very twisted and also selfish and self-aggrandizing. He wants them next to him for his own sake, not necessarily for theirs. And I think that seeing that little glimpse of Anakin both literally and metaphorically in Rebels is very powerful, seeing just his eye behind the mask and knowing that there is still a human being inside that terrifying suit of armor, and plus having this almost emotional vulnerability there, I think is very powerful. It's a very meaningful moment for his character. And I agree with you that there are lots of interpretations to that moment. What is he thinking? I've always taken it as he is kind of having a moment of hesitation of seeing how things could have been different. But, you know, it's kind of the sunk cost fallacy. He is who he is. He is where he is. As he told Obi-Wan and Obi-Wan Kenobi, I am what you made me. He is what he is. And he may not like that, but it is where he is. And I think that it does a masterful job of developing that character.
I know that in our notes you mentioned that there are some really interesting characterization choices and insights that we get into Darth Vader in the Thrawn trilogy, and not the more recent Thrawn trilogy, but also not the first Thrawn trilogy, but the first one that's canon. So the first set of Tim Zahn Thrawn books from canon, because there's a second set that he also recently did. But that first set is interesting because it pairs up Thrawn with Darth Vader in one of the books.
Yeah, it's such a iconic duo moment. This is the second book. I think it's called Thrawn Alliances. Like, I'm 80% sure. At me if I'm wrong. But it's fun because half of it is told in a flashback and it's Thrawn and Anakin teaming up. And then half of it is, you know, 20 years later and it's Thrawn and Darth Vader. And they have such a fun, petty little rivalry. It's Darth Vader at his most petty, I think. And he's clearly very annoyed with Thrawn, which is really fun because we don't necessarily think of Darth Vader having this competitive edge, even though he clearly does. Like, you see it a little bit with Moff Tarkin in A New Hope. You see it a little bit in Rogue One. You even see it with the Emperor. He does have this competitive edge, but we're not necessarily used to seeing him so unsettled, and I really like that element of the book where it's kind of like having to deal with Thrawn is like a splinter under Darth Vader's suit that he has to deal with, and particularly knowing that he knew Thrawn way back when, and that Thrawn knows he was once Anakin. It's just this very Anakin-ish version of Vader that I think it's just a little treat. If you're want to read some books that aren't Vader focused but have a little delicious little slice of pie of Vaderness, recommend that.
Yeah, and of course the great thing about it is it's not just like, as you said, like, you know, a rivalry, a competition with another person who is important and sort of successful and powerful, but it's particularly a person who his whole thing is that he's always one step ahead. And normally, you know, the whole thing with Thrawn in all of these books is like, he'll sort of lay out the situation and be like, well, why do you think this was the case? And like, whoever he is like working with him is like, is it because of this? And Thrawn would be like, close, you're close. And then like eventually Thrawn, you know, like Sherlock will sort of lay out, this is what's going on here. And the other person will be like, oh my God, Thrawn is brilliant. Well, you know, that's an unusual position for Darth Vader to be in, right? Darth Yeah. Vader is usually the one who's always one step ahead, who always has that 360 degree view of the situation. The times when somebody gets the drop on Darth Vader or fools him in some way, those are really precious moments because it's just the side of him that we don't see, you know, him being thrown off balance, him not having considered all the factors. That's kind of every moment with Thrawn to some degree. He's not, you know, a babe in the woods. I mean, he's not a spring chicken here, but like, he's very much not always the one who gets to the answer first. And for Thrawn to be that person, you know, it's got to be frustrating for Vader. And it's also just like, again, these two people who have a lot of stature and a lot of power and are in part of this institution that frankly rewards, you know, backstabbing and climbing on people's shoulders or their dead bodies to get to a position of power. And so there's this tension of like, how are they going to continue to interact with each other? So I do agree that that book is really great for showing that side of Vader, which again, we don't see very often because most of the people who annoy Darth Vader do not live to tell.
And one other thing that I just want to say about that is that we do see Darth Vader unbalanced emotionally. Like when we see him confront Obi-Wan, he is very much off his game, but that's from an emotional basis when he's facing Obi-Wan or facing Ahsoka or facing Luke and having these moments of hesitation. When he is facing off with Thrawn, he's kind of off balance on an intellectual basis, and that's not a position that he's used to being in. And so I think it's really fun for that reason. It's kind of like the two smartest kids in class who absolutely hate each other have to team up, and they're constantly one-upping each other, only, you know, they're also super duper evil and powerful.
Yeah, one of my favorite scenes in that book, just as a tangent, is when Anakin first meets Thrawn, and Thrawn tells him his name, and Anakin tries to pronounce it and repeatedly gets it wrong, and Thrawn's like, Mithran Nuruodo, and Anakin's like, Mithran Nuruodo, and he goes, Mithran Nuruodo, and Anakin goes, that's what I said! I just thought it's like a really great, again, it's this like, that's a point in their lives where they're even more different, and so bringing them together is just really funny in that way. You know, as we go chronologically here, Grace, do we want to talk about Rogue One? Do we want to talk about the hallway murder scene?
We gotta, because it's one of, even though Rogue One only came out like 6 years ago, it is already one of the most iconic Vader appearances that has joined to the pantheon of cool Vader moments. When you think, what's a super cool Vader moment? You think of the hallway scene in Rogue One where he just straight up murders a whole bunch of rebels in the coolest way possible, with Michael Giacchino's score in the background, just an absolute banger. And yes, there is something unsettling about the fact that when you watch it, you can't help but be like, oh yeah, this is the good stuff. Because again, it's wanton murder, but there's just something so compelling about it. And I don't know, it's hard to put your finger on, but for that reason, I think we do have to talk about it.
I think that when you watch that scene, it's like when Kylo Ren is having all the Imperial walkers or First Order walkers fire on Luke on Crait, and he's just like, more! More!
No, I don't want more, though.
But like, it taps into something, I think, primal in a Star Wars fan, which is like, here's the guy who we first saw in this kind of implacable, relentless, you know, pose walking through the doorway, and we just know that anybody that he encounters is gonna die within seconds, right? Because we get that vibe from him right away, but we don't actually see it, right? I mean, he kills Captain Antilles, but there's no sort of combat there, right? And so this is like a very similar location, you know, it's a very similar moment in the chronology. He's facing very similar enemies, but he actually does the thing. And so I think there's like a payoff to that that I think is part of what makes that scene so compelling.
Yeah, that's definitely true. When I say that I don't want more, what I mean is that it's kind of the perfect length of time. It's like less than a minute. And there's something so satisfying about seeing him move so quickly, so effortlessly. Again, this economy of movement that we've talked about, this control over his own steps and over the force. There's just something deeply satisfying about it. And I totally agree that it's kind of fulfilling the Star Wars fans' wish of seeing him go on to the Tantive IV and thinking, okay, there's a story there. How did he get there? And then you see that, chronologically speaking, in universe, 30 seconds ago, he was snapping necks. You're like, yeah, that checks out. This is how it went down. And there's an argument to be made that it's basically just murder porn, but as an unabashed lover of action movies, of really well done action set pieces, I mean, I just love it.
All right, so put Grace down as murder porn enthusiast. Mm-hmm. We've got that now in our notes.
You know, as my resume.
Yeah, right under your Twitter username, in quotes, it just says murder porn enthusiast. So, yes, as you said, 30 seconds later, here he is on the Tantive IV. A very different Vader, right? And, of course, we don't need to get into why that is, right? I mean, there's a reason, and it's called 40 years earlier. But he has, by the time of the original trilogy, for the most part, with the exception of those moments where he's relentlessly trying to, like, recover secret Death Star plans, he isn't so much that kind of ferocious guy anymore in most situations. He is more reserved. It's not that he can't fight if he needs to. It's that he's, you know, his body, while it is being preserved in this suit of armor, is not what it used to be. He is, you know, the years and the damage are catching up to him. And so he does move in a different way. I mean, look at the duel with Ben Kenobi, right? Obviously, we know that Ben Kenobi is pretty old by that point, but you know, Vader himself is no spring chicken. He fights in a different way. There's rigidity to it that I think we don't see 10 years earlier in the Obi-Wan Kenobi series for good reason, which is that the years are taking their toll on him. But another, you know, perhaps the most important thing about his portrayal in the original films is, you know, this is sort of the quintessential, the essence of the mystery of Darth Vader, right? So we've talked with these other stories, it's interesting because of the light that's being shed on these other sides of Darth Vader, and that is inherently fascinating. Here, what's interesting is how little insight we get into who he is and what he's about. Very little character development, flashes, little moments of mostly other people saying things. You know, when Tarkin says, you know, you're the last one that's left from that religion, that, you know, if you're sitting there in 1977, it's like, wow, like, what must it be like to be the one person who survived and to be on the other side of that now? And we can sort of presume, even back then, that you're now on the side that got rid of them, even if we don't know the specifics. And so there's a mystery to who he is and how he's thinking, right? Even us now, watching it, knowing other things about him, there's still a mystery of how is he feeling in that moment, right? We know what led up to the moment, but we don't exactly know how he's thinking about, how he's processing the things that he goes through in the original trilogy. We do get some first-person stuff in some of the stories, but he doesn't really verbalize a lot of this at all. And, you know, just to go back to this point of the helmet makes him enigmatic and you don't know what's going on inside his head. I mean, it isn't just the helmet, right? Because C-3PO also has a droid face that does not move, but you can still tell how he's feeling because he emotes and his voice changes. And just having that droid face is not a barrier to an emotional connection and an understanding of thought process. But with Vader, he keeps it, you know, close to his, you know, robotic chest.
I think part of that is, again, in physicality. So 3PO, he's tilting his head, he's moving his body a lot. And with Vader, he doesn't tilt his head quizzically or in annoyance. He is a very stoic presence. Again, no movement is wasted and that's part of what makes him such an enigmatic individual. Just on a purely metatextual level, something I actually very genuinely enjoy about Star Wars is all the various ways within the narrative that they came up with all these explanations for why the fight in A New Hope between Darth Vader and Ben Kenobi is not as badass, say, as Battle of the Heroes. And I mean, the real answer is because it came out in 1977 and this was brand new technology. But I love all of the in-universe explanations they go through to get there. And I mean, I think it's fun and cool and crafty storytelling that Star Wars has that a lot of other media don't have, just by nature of it being pieced together in such a weird manner. But something else I want to say about original trilogy Vader in A New Hope in particular, why he's so enigmatic. I mean, he's clearly a very bad guy, but he's not necessarily the bad guy. Arguably, Tarkin is just as big of a bad guy, if not more, just on the bureaucratic side, while Vader is on the super cool force choky ancient hokey religion side. And then once we see him in the two subsequent movies, again, very bad guy, but the real villain, the power broker behind the scenes, is the Emperor. So there's something interesting about original trilogy Vader where, you know, he's such a cool character. Part of the reason I think Star Wars in general was so successful in 1977 is because of just having such an instantly iconic villain. That's a big part of it. But the other thing about him is that he's very much a lackey, a glorified lackey. And yeah, he's the top dog lackey. He's the right-hand man of the Emperor, but he's still number two. And that's very apparent, I think, in the original trilogy. And that's part of what makes his character so interesting, and then his redemption so interesting, is because he's ultimately not the big bad.
Yeah, I mean, in any other story, a guy who looks like that and has those powers would be the top dog, right? He would be the ultimate, he'd be the final boss. So to have him here be on a leash to some degree, he's an attack dog, really. It's just a compelling place to put somebody like that, because he could snap pretty much anybody's neck except Palpatine's if he wanted to, but he still listens to Tarkin. You know, when Mahdi, you know, insults him, Tarkin's still able to get him to not kill Mahdi. And that is just like, if you think about the power dynamic there and how it clashes with what you would expect from the sort of the visual language of that scene and what Vader looks like compared to the rest of them, it's just an interesting story choice to make, to have him be constrained in this way. And, you know, to your point about, like, he, you know, he is a lackey, and over time he, you know, as you said, he becomes, I maybe more comfortable with it isn't the right term, but like by the time of Return of the Jedi, as you said in our notes, you know, he at that point has sort of abandoned all qualms about, you know, being a servant of the Emperor. You know, he's not trying to take over anymore, which he claimed he wanted to do, you know, in Empire Strikes Back when he was seducing Luke. There's that great scene on the, like, catwalk after Luke surrenders to Vader on Endor, and Luke says, you know, I know that there's still good in you. We can get out of here, and basically you can be redeemed. And he basically says, it's too late for me, son. And I just love thinking about how he's thinking in that moment, because it's like, I have all this power. I have more power than most people who have ever lived in this galaxy could even dream of. But all that ability to move rocks and swing a lightsaber and choke people, like, telekinetically, like, that is nothing compared to the power that the Emperor has over me. And it's not the Force. it is something else. It is a different kind of stranglehold that he has on Vader. And I like the fact that this person who has all this power actually acknowledges in this almost mournful way that, like, he doesn't have a way out, and he's aware of that just as much as Sidious is.
Yeah, I was just thinking of another good moment, kind of expanding on that theme at the very end of Return of the Jedi, when Palpatine is using Force Lightning on Luke, and Luke is screaming and writhing in pain. And the scene repeatedly cuts to show Vader's helmet. And there's something almost funny about the repeated cuts, because that helmet is so, it reveals nothing. It's basically just showing him standing by stoically while his son is being tortured on the floor. And so whatever you see there in his helmet in that scene, if you think to yourself, yeah, wow, he's changing his mind, he's making decisions, that's not actually betrayed at all by that frame of his unmoving helmet. It's you, the viewer, projecting your own emotions onto it, kind of Vader as the blank slate. And then, of course, he does end up picking up the Emperor and throwing him down. But I love that little enigmatic scene of knowing that there's something happening behind the helmet, that he is making a decision, but having that absolutely not betrayed at all by the lack of expression externally. And that's just a fun sort of further demonstration of seeing in real time the hold that Palpatine has loosed, and seeing the power of his unselfish love for his son triumph over the corruption that has motivated for so long. But at the same time, as we're watching that happen in real time, we're not actually seeing it. We know it's happening because of what happens next. But if you're just looking at that helmet, you know, you can't tell that there's anything happening back there.
Yeah, it makes that final decision that he makes when he suddenly lurches forward and grabs Sidious, it makes it more surprising. I mean, contrast that with Anakin's, you know, the moment arguably when he becomes Darth Vader, which is when he cuts off Mace Windu's arm. That move, even though as fans we knew Anakin was going to become Vader, but we didn't know exactly how or when it was going to happen. And so even though as soon as that scene began, we were all very kind of, okay, could this be when it happens? We didn't know exactly when it was going to happen, but Anakin telegraphed pretty clearly that scene was leading to something bad, because he was constantly saying, no, we need him alive. It's not the Jedi way. We can't kill him, right? So there's that buildup to he's going to make an impulsive decision to, you know, to effectuate the conclusion that he has come to, which is that Palpatine needs to survive. In this scene in Return of the Jedi, the conclusion that he comes to is not telegraphed. And so that makes it all the more interesting when he finally makes the move to carry out the decision he's made, because none of that, there's no buildup to that. He doesn't tell his master maybe it would be better to keep Luke alive or something like that. There's none of that. It's all, as you said, happening inside his head. So it makes it more interesting and surprising when he actually lurches into action.
I think there's something very interesting too about his final scenes as Darth Vader. I think we should wrap up by talking, kind of getting full circle, since we're talking about Anakin falling into Darth Vader in Revenge of the Sith, and then Return of the Jedi really ends with Darth Vader redeeming himself and becoming Anakin again as he once was. And the moment of Luke removing his helmet and having this almost anticlimactic moment of seeing that underneath that terrifying visage was just a man, kind of a gross and icky looking man at that. Something very pathetic about him, and not just because he is now at this point literally dying. But again, bringing back that human element to Vader, letting him connect with Luke, let me see you with my own eyes just once, having him connect as father and son, as Anakin and Luke, in person in a way that they really weren't with him wearing the helmet. And I think that there is something very beautiful in those final moments of highlighting the human element of him. And yes, he's still, you know, a war criminal who did unspeakable things, uncountable unspeakable things. And yet in this moment, he is also a father with his son. And I think part of what makes Vader so compelling is that he has so many facets. And in that moment, it's all of it. He is the monster and he is the father and he is the redeemed in this one very sad dying man.
Yeah. And implicit in that is the lesson that, like, behind every monster, there is a human being, right? I mean, people are not born monsters. They become monsters through their choices. And so literally pulling back the mask of this iconic monster in American culture, world culture, really, is there's a person there. Like, there's a Wizard of Oz quality to it of, like, taking away the mystique, but also taking away the brutality. Yes, this is just a human being. He did horrible things, but he's not some unknowable creature from another dimension. You know, some version of this could be you if you make the wrong choices. I think that is kind of implicit in this unmasking and the reveal of this sort of pathetic human underneath this terrifying visage. You know, I will just say briefly as we wrap up here, speaking of the terrifying visage, if you're interested in more Darth Vader content, if this episode gets you thinking about Darth Vader and how cool he is, some of the best Darth Vader stories are in the comics. There's a Darth Vader comic. There's also a comic called Dr. Aphra, and he plays a very important role in that comic. And in both of them, it's really Darth Vader in his prime. It's set in between the movies of the original trilogy, and he is that classic Vader that you want to see more of. Comics, surprisingly, a very interesting and successful medium for doing a Darth Vader story, because oftentimes the panels in the comics are just his silent visage, right? Just the mask. And you can tell, because of what happened before or what happens after, that it's having an impact. Whatever's going on around him is having an impact. But you don't know exactly what he's thinking. And those silent panels where he's not speaking, he's not moving, and the other people around him, they're always wondering what he's thinking, what he's about to do. I mean, that is the power of Darth Vader, is that you're always uneasy around him because even, you know, you don't know what he's going to do next. And the comics are a great medium for showing that that's the kind of power that he wields. They are very effective at portraying that side of Darth Vader where, you know, you're in the room with him as an Imperial officer or somebody who's tagging along on a mission with him. And he might not be trying to kill you in that moment, but you have to be very careful because he doesn't care about you. You, unless you're Darth Sidious, you are a means to an end. And he will be able to kill you with impunity if he really wants to. And he just might want to, depending on the situation. So I think all of that, if that's the kind of thing that's interesting and compelling to you from Darth Vader, check out these comics because they are really great at that.
And I know there are a ton of Darth Vader media that we miss too. Like, I know he shows up in the Jedi Fallen Order video game, more comics. I know he shows up in more books. So if there is any Darth Vader content that you think we missed and that you want to shout out, please hit us up. And I will use this to transition to tell you that if you want to share your thoughts with us, you can add us on Twitter at HothTakes. You can also email us at HothTakes@gmail.com. I'm at Grace_Seegers on Twitter. Eric is at Eric Geller. and Haley is at Birdnator. Haley made our incredible art and logo, and Eric edited the show and put together our music, although for legal purposes, as always, we should note that all Star Wars themes and sound effects are the intellectual property of Lucasfilm. You can find a complete archive of past episodes on our website, hottakes.wordpress.com. And if you like the show, if you want to talk more about Darth Vader with your fellow nerds in your life, share it with a friend. You can find Hoth Takes on all the major podcasting platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. We will see you next time. Neither of us are your father. And may the Force be with you.